To be sure, there are phrases in Proverbs which are arresting and apt, even when they suffer by translation. As an example, it is no good. It is no good. So says the buyer. But as he goes his way, he congratulates himself. Better a dry crust and an easy mind than a house full of feasting and quarreling. The heart knows its own bitterness, but no stranger shares its joys. As a door turns on its pivot, so a lazy man turns on his bed. It is better to live in the corner of a roof than with a quarrelsome woman in a luxurious house. Present company accepted. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the back of fools. Or why schoolmasters bemoan the old days. Two differences between Bartlett's and Proverbs are immediately apparent. The Bible text is not alphabetically or topically arranged. And there is a further difference. There is much material in Proverbs which is longer and more sustained than a quip or an aphorism. Take, for instance, this rather extended portrait of a drunk. It begins with a series of questions. Who groans, alas? Who cries, woe is me? Who gets into quarrels? Who raves on, who hurts himself needlessly, whose eyes are bloodshot? The answer, those who linger over wine and those who drain the mixing bowl. Do not gloat over the redness of wine when it sparkles in the cup, or the smoothness of wine when it goes down easily. After it is over, it will bite like a snake and sting like a viper. Your eyes will see strange apparitions. Your mind and speech will be confused. You will be like one who is seasick, who rolls dizzily about as if he's at the top of a mast, saying, they hit me, but it didn't hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. As soon as I can wake up, I'll take another drink. A somewhat clearer picture of our book is given by its Hebrew title, Mishle. Mashal in Hebrew means a parable, any teaching which uncovers meaning. The Hebrew Mishle have an ancient heritage, and they have a classic form. We know of Near Eastern collections of parables and proverbs and sayings which go back to 2500 BC and are of Egyptian origin. Many of these sayings were undoubtedly passed on from father to son and from teacher to pupil, from the earliest days of the Hebrew tribes. And not all of the sayings in Mishle are original to Israel. These sayings deal with the routine, everyday experiences of life, and they are a part of the general culture of the Near East. In Bartlett's quotations or any other modern collection, the emphasis is usually on the well-turned phrase. In Proverbs, the sayings have a classic form, not unlike the forms of Hebrew poetry, which we discussed last week. The basic form is that of a couplet, two lines, where the emphasis is on brevity, on compactness of thought, and a certain rhythm in the language. This couplet shows the same parallelism of lines which we saw in Hebrew poetry. Each half of the verse amplifies or deepens or points up a suggestion implicit in the other. The second half of the couplet illumines and illustrates the first by emphasizing it, by twisting it slightly, or by suggesting alternative or opposite meanings. Typically, the thoughts of the righteous are proper. The counsel of the wicked are deceiving. There you have an opposite parallelism. Or better to be an ordinary man who has a job than to give oneself airs and to be starving. The overwhelming majority of the sayings in our book have this couplet form. A few are tristitches of three line elements. A verse form which from which we took the line which we used as the title to Dr. Silver's anniversary volume. You remember In the Time of Harvest? The line originally reads, "As the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is the faithful messenger to them that send him, for he refreshes the soul of his master." A few further paragraphs are quatrains, four elements reflecting on a single theme. "Do not fret yourself about wrongdoers. Do not be envious of the wicked. The bad man has nothing to look forward to, and the lamp of the wicked shall be put out." And there are still larger stanzas. I've already quoted to you the long chapter on the drunkard, but I insist that the classic form, the usual form, is the couplet. And the bulk of our book is written in this two-lined parallel form. The couplets begin in chapter 10 of the book of Proverbs, and I'd like you to turn to it. They begin in chapter 10, and they run on pretty much uninterrupted through chapter 29. Notice, if you just leaf ahead, that the editors have divided off verse from verse, and you do have a sense of this couplet form. Notice the introduction, the Proverbs of Solomon, an indication that what goes before came originally from some other scroll, but more of that later. Proverbs of Solomon. King Solomon was revered in ancient Israel as the patron of the proverb and the nation's most talented writer of these sayings. Even as we noticed last week, King David was known as the patron of the poetry, the Psalms, and the nation's most talented psalmist. How many of these verses were Solomon's, or whether in fact he wrote any of them, is a moot question. These verses are ancient. I have spoken of our knowledge of this form of writing as early as the 25th century before the Common Era. In Egypt, we know of it from the 18th and 17th centuries in Mesopotamia. And there can be no doubt that the pre-exilic historians, that is the historians of Israel before the year 586, before the Common Era, conceived and knew Solomon as without peer in these matters. One of the classic descriptions of Solomon appears in 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 9 through 14. It reads to this effect: "And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Athan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Machol. And his fame was in all the nations round about. And he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts, and of fowl, and of creeping things, and of fish. And there came of all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings of the earth, who had heard of his wisdom." The Bible describes Solomon as a royal Aesop, who tells fables dealing with wild animals and domesticated animals, of the things that grow. None of the proverbs in the book of Proverbs are of this nature. If Solomon was indeed this kind of author, this material has been lost. Although we do have in the Talmud a number of stories which are attributed 1,000 years later to this wise king. We don't know who Athan and Heman and Chalcol and Darda were, but notice the reference to the wisdom of all the children of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Wisdom literature, the proverb, was a common form of literature. It is not unique to Israel. Prophecy was unique to Israel. The Psalms, in their present form, were unique to Israel. The Proverbs were not. Nor do we know of 3,000 Proverbs by King Solomon. It's hard to know which of the Proverbs were by this king, but it's interesting to note If we begin on chapter 10, where the couplets begin, and we cut out the portions where there are indications that this is another collection that has been added in, there are a number of such indications, we come to the number of quatrains of couplets as 375. And interestingly, you write Solomon's name in Hebrew, and you take the equivalent, numerical equivalent of each of the letters, the shin is equivalent to 300, the lamed to 30, the mem to 40, and the hey to 5. You have 375. So apparently some editor took an arbitrary form, 300 equivalent to the number of implicit in Solomon's name, and gave us a collection of 375 proverbs. Whether others were simply deemed not worth being kept, we don't know. This is apparently the basic structure of this book. Now the important thing, however, is to notice how Israel's proverbs differ from those of Egypt and of Mesopotamia. And the basic difference is this. Egyptian proverb is directed to the royalty. It is the proverb which a king addresses to his people, or a king addresses to the royal prince. Mesopotamian proverb is proverb put in the mouth of the gods. Ashtur and Marduk address the members of the royal house and give them advice on how to rule the kingdom. Israel's proverb is much more folksy and humane. It is the proverb of a teacher to a student, of a father to a son. There is no apparent royal intent in most of this literature, with one or two exceptions. And therefore it has lasted. Royalty has disappeared, polytheism has disappeared, but fathers and sons and teachers and students remain. The question of Solomon's authorship then is moot. But there seems no doubt that the language and the content of chapters 10 through 29 is early. And whether Solomon wrote it or not, it reveals much of the thinking and of the attitudes among the Israelite people in the 8th, 9th, and 7th centuries before the Common Era. Let me take you back now to chapter 10 of the book of Proverbs, and try to give you an example of the way in which these proverbs came to be used. Some began as folk wisdom. The quotation that a parent had on the tip of his tongue when his son skipped off and missed school, or when he sassed father back, or did anything else that sons have been known to do. Someone described this kind of proverb as the wisdom of many, capsuled by the wit of one. And these proverbs were collected for a didactic or educational purpose. And they were given to children as set pieces, which they had to memorize. Some of you may remember the old forms of Sunday schools here in America. The child was given, as at the beginning of each year, a number of moralisms, truisms. Honor becomes the child. Speak the truth always. And it was assumed that by memorizing these, he had made them part of himself and they would become part of his moral equipment. And this is essentially one of the ways in which the proverbs were used in ancient Israel. But there was a deeper reason. And I'm afraid that most of those who have explained the book of Proverbs, writing books, have missed this deeper reason. They have seen the book of Proverbs as practical wisdom, the kind of information that a father talks over with his son when he sits down for that heart-to-heart conversation that we always keep putting off but inevitably have. The hard, practical wisdom that father assumes Junior won't get in school or from his friends, and that he has to have in order to be equipped for life. But what we have not seen is that this is only part of the story. A proverb uncovers deep truth. And the book of Proverbs was written to include not just prosaic, down-to-earth information. Honesty is a good policy, that kind of thing. But to reveal the basic truths of life, death, purpose, meaning, morality, right and wrong, and so on. The first paragraph which introduces the book of Proverbs suggests this to us, without moving from chapter 10. Let me just read it to you, because we'll come back to it in a minute. Here's the introduction to the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to receive the discipline of wisdom, justice and right and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. Well, that everyone has seen. But also, that the wise man may hear and increase in learning, and the man of understanding may attain unto wise counsel. In other words, the graybeard can learn from this book. But one more thing. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. We have then given to us as a key for reading the book the fact that there is more to this book than appears on the surface. And it's our responsibility to dig it out. These couplets were the logs of culture, which the skill of teachers and of experience built into a fire and kindled to enlighten their age. What I'm saying is this. This book could be used at many levels. It's like the story of Moby Dick. Moby Dick can be read as a simple adventure story, the eagerness with which a man gripped by the passion to kill the white whale goes after the white whale and finally kills the whale and is killed in the process. As we get older, we realize that the story of Moby Dick is also an allegory. It says something about the human soul possessed by passion and how an all-consuming passion ultimately destroys the soul. We broaden it, in other words, and deepen it from the story to a basic life truth. And there is this basic truth throughout the book of Proverbs. And what I'd like to do this afternoon, is to take one or two of these Proverbs and to try and see if together we can't look beneath and behind the text. Play the role of the rhetor, of the teacher, of the sage with you, and show you what a text can be made to mean. Now, I make no claim that the meaning I will read into these texts was the meaning that was originally intended. I'm only going to try to open up for you the kind of approach that was used in the academies of ancient Judea when they dealt with this material. And I've deliberately chosen the first two of these couplets because they seem rather prosaic on the surface, and I think they're the most interesting for our purpose. Proverb 10:1. A wise son maketh a glad father, and a foolish son is the grief of his mother. Now it seems that we have here nothing more than the statement it's better to be wise than to be foolish. But before ticking it off as a truism, note that throughout the book of Proverbs, wisdom implies learning and much more. We find, for instance, this phrase in the Proverbs. I am wisdom, my neighbor is intelligence. I am found in company with knowledge and thought. Pride, arrogance, wicked behavior, and perverse speech I hate. So when they talk of wisdom, they're talking not only of information, factual guidance. They're talking of a whole stance towards life and moral attitude, which implies a judgment on pride, arrogance, gossip, and so on. Note the results in this line of wisdom and folly. Wisdom brings joy to a father, folly, grief to the mother. Somehow the author knew well the father who reacts to a neighbor's call about a broken window by turning to mother and saying, "He's your son." The father who takes the good report card to the office, "He's my boy." Now, as we know more and more of the book of Proverbs, we realize that there are parallels to this literature. Chapter 15, verse 10, I believe it is, reads, "A wise son maketh a glad father," exact parallel, "a foolish man despises his mother." Here we see something, by the way, of how these couplets came to be together. Apparently, there was a common saying in ancient Israel, among an old wives' saying, we could call it, that a good boy makes his parents happy. A wise son maketh a glad father. And the ingenuity of the man who wrote Proverbs lay in the writing a second couplet, which would deepen and embroider and clarify the meaning. Note that the subject is a boy. Ancient education was largely male. And indeed, there is a tendency to look on the Bible as a man's literature, and the biblical world as a world in which the woman was second class, if not second rate. But note that the second proverb implies that the mother plays an integral role in the boy's education, because it's only when you rebel against somebody's counsel that you end up, for the moment, despising them. Indeed, nowhere in the Bible, and this is an interesting fact about the book of Proverbs, nowhere in the Bible is the respect in Israel for its women more explicit than in this book. My son, keep the commandments of thy father and forsake not the teachings of thy mother. The mother was teacher, and there was no higher title of honor than that of teacher in Israel. Rabbi is teacher. The eye that mocketh at his father and despises to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out. As parents, father and mother bear and share equal responsibility. A wife, a mother, a woman, a good woman, is freely and often and highly praised. The last chapter of Proverbs, which is an appendix to this whole book, includes the famous passage, Aishas Hayel, a woman of valor. The poem is an acrostic, which, as I told you last week, is a somewhat limiting verse form. But the feeling of respect for decency and for woman is largely sustained. And I would remind you of this. In this poem's unabashed statement of the crucial role of women and of the dignity to which woman is capable, you will not find the parallel to this poem until modern times. This is the greatest statement of the role of the integrity, of the beauty of womankind in all of ancient literature. Let me read it with you. It's one way to get you on my side today. A woman of valor, who can find? Her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, and he hath no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ship, she bringeth her food from afar. She riseth up also while it is yet night, and giveth food to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hands, she planteth a vineyard. Wives worked with husbands in those days as today. She girds her loins with strength and maketh strong her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her lamp goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes for herself coverlet. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates where he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and delivers girdles unto the merchants. Strength, dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the law of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and eats not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done valiantly, but thou excellest them all. Grace is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. I read this section with a high school group some years ago. And one young man rather perceptively turned to me and said, Rabbi, you shouldn't read this to me. And I said, why not? He said, you'll spoil me. I'll never get married. So there is in the book of Proverbs this wonderful sense of respect for the integrity of a woman. And interesting, there is also in the book of Proverbs one of the few cases where the advice of women is sought and is repeated. The beginning of the selfsame chapter, chapter 31, begins the words of King Lemuel, the burden wherewith his mother corrected him. Now, no one knows who King Lemuel was, and the Talmud simply assumes that King Lemuel is Solomon. And the Talmud tells a delightful story about this section. Bathsheba, whom you remember, David's paramour, was the mother of King Solomon. And after her one fling, she became quite a respectable matron in Jerusalem. Now, Solomon was young, and he was feeling his oats. And one of the first things Solomon did in his reign was to look around for the most beautiful women of the ancient world, and he married them. And one of those whom he married was a princess of Egypt. And on the marriage night, there was great festivity. And Solomon got a little shicker. And then Solomon spent a very enjoyable evening. And then Solomon overslept the next morning. Now, there was only one problem with this. In ancient Israel, only the king had the key to the sanctuary. He kept it in the pocket of his robe. And the next morning when the people came to the temple to offer the morning sacrifices, the gates were locked shut and the high priest had to say, I can't do anything about it. Solomon has the key. And the people came swarming around the palace, and Bathsheba heard this incipient rebellion and she went in to shake Solomon awake. And then she did something that I bet you've always wanted to do, according to the story. She tied Solomon down to the bed. You ever want to sit on a child to pound in the truth? Well, she tied him down to the bed. And while he was tied, she read him the riot act. And this is the riot act that she read to him that day. What, my son, or what, O son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows? Give not thy strength unto women, nor thy ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes to say, where is strong drink? Lest they drink and forget that which is decreed, and pervert the justice due to any that is afflicted. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto the bitter in soul. Let him drink, and let him forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. But open thy mouth for the dumb, and the cause of all such as are apportioned to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. Good lesson for an incipient drunk who is also king, president, cabinet minister. Wine has its place for the poor, the bitter in soul, the anguished, but not for the man who's charged with responsibility. And I often read this when I hear of how much of the diplomacy of the world is conducted at cocktail parties. Now, interestingly also, this book, which has so much respect for woman written into it, is the book which is most violent in its denunciation of what used to be called the fallen woman, the prostitute, the streetwalker. After all, this kind of woman threatens the very sanctity of the home. And a book which is praising the virtues of home life inevitably includes the kind of condemnation of sexual promiscuity, which our generation doesn't like to hear. But it's part of the biblical tradition. Turn to chapter 7, if you will, of the book. And this is, in a sense, the reverse of the woman of valor. I begin reading on verse 6. For at the window of my house, I looked forth through my lattice, and I beheld among the thoughtless ones, I discerned among the youth a young man void of understanding passing through the street near her corner. And he went the way to her house. In the twilight, in the evening of the day, in the blackness of the night, in the darkness, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot, wily of heart. She is riotous and rebellious. Her feet abide not in her house. Now she is in the streets, now in the broad places, and she lies in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. And with an impudent face she said unto him, sacrifices of peace offering were due from me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my couch with coverlets, with striped cloths of the yarn of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come then. Let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He hath taken the bag of money with him. He will come home at the full moon. With her much fair speech, she causes him to yield. With a blandishment of her lips, she entices him away. He goeth after her straightway as an ox that goeth to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the correction of the fool, till an arrow strike through his liver, as a bird hasteneth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is at the cost of his life. Now therefore, ye children, hearken unto me and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thy heart decline to her ways, go not astray in her paths, for she hath cast down many wounded, yea, a mighty host are all her slain. Her house is the way to the netherworld, a going down to the chambers of death. Any civilization which respects woman must also have contempt for the fallen woman. But of course, today we would say this has to be amplified. The burden is all on the woman. But the biblical teaching is to the young man, the innocent man. I'm sure that the Bible would have been equally violent in its denunciation of the mature and experienced who yet seek this kind of release. Where comes then our image of the woman as peripheral, as subordinate, as always belonging in the Weiberschule, behind walls, upstairs? How does this come into Jewish life? How is it that a traditional Jew to this day begins his morning with 100 blessings, one of which says, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, shelo asani isha. Praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman. By the way, there was a proposition given to the Central Conference of American Rabbis that in the re-editing of our prayer book, we include the prayer, Praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, please make me a woman. So much has our society changed. But in any case, Judaism did develop a second-class citizenship for the woman, but not in Bible days. Not until much later, under Muslim influence, when the harem and the veil and the shaving of the head, when the woman was put into purda, a form of protective isolation, where she was allowed only to have conversation with her husband and the eunuch of the house and no other. And Muslim influence did greatly change the Jewish attitude towards women, even as Reform and liberal Judaism has changed it back again. But we've only returned it to its biblical base. In the Bible, woman, though not man's equal, how could she be conceived of that in a world where fighting and was the business of the day, really? Was respected. Women were judges in Israel. Women were the matriarchs. Women were prophetesses. Women were the women of valor. Now we have wandered far from our original proverb, a wise son maketh a glad father, and a foolish son is the grief of his mother. But I've stuck to one theme, father and mother and the relationship of parents to children, of man to wife, of the society to man and to woman. And this is precisely the way in which an ancient rhetor or teacher would have taken one of these texts. And one of the mistakes that I'm afraid many of us make is we try to read them just on down. We glance over the surface and we skim as if we were on ice skates. And we don't remember the text. For the virtue of an epigram is simply that it suggests to us a whole series of ideas. Not that we take it at its narrowest meaning. Let's try one more. Number 2, chapter 10, verse 2. Treasures of wickedness profit not, but righteousness delivers from death. In biblical times, this meant both, you can't take it with you, and the piety that good deeds delay death. The first of these statements that you can't take it with you is often repeated in the Bible and in all literature. It's an obvious statement. Oh, that we were wise, that we may consider our latter end, for when we die, we can carry away nothing with us. Our glory cannot descend after us. The second is a perhaps unusual statement, but we still have remnants of it in the Yom Kippur liturgy, when we read that prayer and repentance and charity can avert the evil decree. Tfila, tshuva, tzedakah, ma'avirin, roach ha'gezerah. In this connection that somehow good deeds delay death, an interesting piety developed in the first and second centuries of the Common Era. And that is that the relationship of man to God had a certain banking element to it. Man's good deeds were noted by God. And if man had enough good deeds, he'd build up quite a bank account in heaven. And God owed him, in a sense, certain favors. And therefore, the truly saintly man, it was held, could call upon God, and his prayer had to be answered. God owed him the favor. And we find in the Talmud the interesting story of a man named Honi, who was known as the circle maker. The great problem as far as the economics of the day was a problem of rain. There wasn't enough rain, there was famine. Well, Honi was a professional rainmaker, but he didn't have the stick that you carry in front of you that sort of titillates when you come and find a well. He didn't have all the knowledge of modern meteorology. All he had was a store of good deeds in heaven. And so when the country needed rain, he drew a circle around himself, and he looked up at the heavens, and he took his fist like this, and he says, God, I won't move from here if you let me withdraw from my bank account. And the rains came. But we no longer believe this kind of piety, of course. But it's interesting to note also that neither did the book of Proverbs. It's not so much that good deeds give us a longer life, but that they give us a better life. You find this interesting line in the book of Proverbs. The Lord will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish, and he taketh away the desires of the wicked. The Lord will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish, but he taketh away the desire of the wicked. Proverbs does not say the Lord will not suffer the righteous to famish, but the soul of the righteous. Somehow, the good man has a fuller inner life. And the man whose concerns are purely materialistic has a narrow and strained inner life. And even though he may be surrounded by much more, he doesn't respond with the fullness and the expansiveness of the other. The great reward is the reward of a finer life. Now, later generations read into this, treasures of wickedness profit not, but righteousness delivereth from death, the promise of immortality. I believe that the original proverbial truth was simply the death which is a living death. But in any case, it is true that our people over the years believed that tzedakah tatzil mimavet, that righteousness delivereth from death. And because the word tzedakah means not only righteousness but charity, you develop the piety that you could actually buy through charity your entrance or the entrance of your loved ones into heaven. And there are many, many of the old charity boxes which were kept in the synagogues of ancient Europe, with this line that I've been reading to you from 10:2, tzedakah tatzil mimavet, where the motivation for the giving was not only the motivation of charity, but that somehow by the giving, you were gaining your immortality. Now, of course, the rabbis in their wisdom broadened and deepened this truth. They reversed it again. Tzedakah is charity, and tzedakah is justice. By the doing of that which is required of us, we build our own immortality. And isn't this true? Now, what is our immortality? Our immortality is essentially the enlightenment of our children, the strength of the institutions to which we have lent our support. They live on. You've been active in a temple, you've been active in a school, with a university, with a hospital. It will continue to bless the community long after you have died. So your charity, your gift, given through the institution, given through personal relationship, establishes your immortality. Beyond this, they played again with these words. Tzedakah is justice. Tzedakah implies that charity is not in fact charity, the giving of something that you don't have to give. According to our Jewish tradition, all that we have is but lent to us. Man is but a steward. God possesses all. We Jews have done well under capitalism, but we cannot religiously be fundamentalist capitalists. Because essentially, our religion does not permit us to believe that all what that we have is due to our own merit. Who are we to say that we deserve to be a millionaire and Einstein died with a few thousand dollars? Who are we to say that a farmer deserves to be paid at one rate of pay and a teacher at another rate of pay and a scientist at a third rate of pay and a corporate executive at a fourth? Who is to say what is the legitimate wealth that a man earns by the work of his hands? The wealth is essentially the wealth of the community. And if you're fortunate enough to have been given or granted or to have earned, although that's a word that's a very slippery word, if you're fortunate enough to have more, it is your responsibility to see that the entire community benefits from the prosperity which is yours. Now, we've had our Ganoven, our robber barons, but essentially they've had to move against the religious tradition, and essentially our people have a magnificent record of understanding that we must share and participate in all the communal activity, and it is not charity. It is not a gift of our largesse. It is a duty imposed upon us by birth and by God. Tzedakah tzatzil mimavis, righteousness delivereth from death. We could go on and play with this theme in many ways. But enough has been said again to suggest the filigree of ideas which an ancient teacher might have added to this single log of learning. Essentially, then, each proverb suggests a cluster of ideas and of associations. It provided a text on which teacher and or parent or senior citizen could depend, could lean, as he sought to expose the range of Israel's attitudes and values and teachings to a younger generation, or to someone who was asking, or to himself if he had to review. Proverbs, unfortunately, tends to be ticked off as a rather limited book, circumscribed in its breadth, especially by Christians. Christianity tends to believe that that religion is the best when it's the most unworldly. The most moral act is the act which is most unexpected. Judaism doesn't have this prejudice. And so we can take this book as good advice on a very practical level, and we can also deepen this book to be the profounder advice on a philosophic level. Now, I read to you the opening few lines of the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs, as I have dealt with it up to now, is this 375 couplets with few additions between chapters 10 and chapters 29. The opening nine chapters of the book of Proverbs are of another nature. They are not couplets. They don't have this essentially parallelistic form. They are, by the way, of being introductions to the general theme of wisdom. And we need to understand this theme in a broader sense. Let's take as our text chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a carefully constructed address, 22 lines corresponding to the lines of the alphabet, but not an acrostic. It advertises the satisfaction which wisdom brings and safeguards, and it advertises the safeguards which wisdom provides against bad influence. My son, if thou wilt receive my words and lay up my commandments with thee, so that thou make thine ear attend unto wisdom and thy heart incline to discernment, yea, if thou call for understanding and lift up thy voice for discernment, if thou seek her as silver and search for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. The Lord giveth wisdom. Out of his mouth cometh knowledge and discernment. He layeth up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to them that walk in integrity, that he may guard the paths of justice and preserve the ways of his godly ones. Then shalt thou understand righteousness and justice and equity, yea, every good path. For wisdom shall enter into thy heart, and knowledge shall be pleasant unto thy soul. Discretion shall watch over thee, discernment shall guard thee to deliver thee from the way of evil, from the men that speak froward things, who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice to do evil and delight in the frowardness of evil, who are crooked in their ways and perverse in their paths, to deliver thee from the strange woman, even from the alien woman, and make a smooth her words. that forsaketh the Lord of her youth and forgetteth the covenant of her God. For her mouth, her house sinketh down unto death, and her paths unto the shades. Then that go unto her return, neither do they attain unto the paths of life, that thou mayest walk in the way of the good men, and keep the paths of the righteous. For the upright shall dwell in the land, and the wholehearted shall remain in it. But the wicked shall be cut off from the land, and faithfulness shall be plucked up out of it. Now the sense we get out of this chapter, with all its excess, it's almost oriental in that sense, is that wisdom is somehow an entity unto itself. And if you get this thing called wisdom, you're the better for it. Better human being, a more moral person, happier, you have peace of mind. And there is even a physical reward in this life promised. Now we've moved down from pre-exilic times to closer to into Greek times. We moved from Hebrew teachers to the example of a Greek rhetor, of a Greek sage. In Greece, wisdom, which was called Sophia, had a definite value. If you learned wisdom, which was a combination of practical advice, experience, logic, metaphysics, philosophy, science, in other words, the academic curriculum of the day, and learned it truly, as opposed to the half-known truths of the day or the superstitions of the day, you became a different kind of human being. This was then the belief that somehow education civilizes. But they went further. You gained immortality. You became one with the gods. You ever wondered where the phrase the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost comes from? What is the Holy Ghost? The Holy Ghost is essentially a Christian version of Logos or Sophia or wisdom. It is the way in which God relates to man. God created this world in wisdom, but man cannot approach God. What is there that is godlike in man? The intellect. But it is obvious that many men are boors and many men are fools. So it's a certain kind of intellect, the intellect which has gained true knowledge, true information, and true thought. And insofar as you gain this true knowledge and true information, you have become one unto the God. You have become immortal. Wisdom is essentially a do-it-yourself immortality. Now, wisdom had a special connotation. I've used philosophic words. But wisdom essentially meant, in these days, the Stoic philosophy of the Greeks. And essentially, Stoicism was this. Life is black and gray. We live on quicksand. There is no stability. There is no assurance that there will be tomorrow. There's no assurance that our love won't turn into ashes. There's no assurance that our loved ones will not die. There's no assurance that our hand, so skillful at some craft, will not lose its cunning. Therefore, the skill which man most requires is an ability not to get too involved in life. To cut yourself off from life when you're still in the fullness of your powers. Don't plunge in. Stoicism is at war with passion. Don't plunge in. Don't make the mistake of believing that you can conquer the world or that you can impose your will upon the world. You can't impose your will on yourself. Learn to take everything as if you were one step removed from it. You must live. But essentially, you can live without, you can put your hand into the fire without being burnt if you don't believe that you're going to do this. It's not within your power to be assured of it. And so the Stoics, the great Roman emperor, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, Lucretius, the great teachers of Greece and Rome all taught a doctrine of withdrawal, of self-discipline and self-control. The very antithesis of the kind of doctrine which is so preached to our young today, of getting out and being involved in, of empathy, of concern, of passion, of commitment. And the Jews living in this Greek world took over this attitude to a large degree. And they called it not Sophia, not philosophia, philosophy, but wisdom. And they said that the wisdom a man must learn is the wisdom of Torah. And insofar as man learns Torah, he learns two things. One, to discipline himself in life. Two, how to become immortal. How to become one with the God. The great teachers of this wisdom set out these long paragraphs in praise of her to encourage people to come to their schools. For essentially, they had to do this. They had to convince that generation that it was more important for the son to come to college than to go into his father's business. And the father, who had made a good living and was a good citizen and had made his way in the world, couldn't see the value of this kind of philosophic knowledge. You can't turn it into dollars and cents. What's the virtue for it? And they competed in writing these kind of introductory chapters which emphasized the great importance of wisdom. Now, wisdom is not the entirety of Judaism. Wisdom isn't even a good definition of Judaism, because prophecy speaks of pursuing righteousness, of burning out the evil that's within the midst. But this was the tenor of the day, and the rabbis reflected this tenor. And in the Apocrypha, from about the same time, we have this direct statement of how this kind of wisdom is to lead you to immortality. The beginning of wisdom is the most sincere desire for instruction. And concern for instruction is love of her, and love of her is the keeping of the laws. And the giving heed to her laws is the assurance of immortality. And immortality brings one near to God. So the desire for wisdom leads to a kingdom. Now, this kind of thinking is entirely foreign to us today. There are, however, strands of Stoicism still among us. The person who says, you're not going to change the world. Don't get involved in placards and picketing. Don't get all fired head up about this crusade or that. Keep your nose to the grindstone. Don't get your name on an organization's list. Make your living, ask nothing of the community, and don't impose your passions upon the community. This is wisdom in its crassest sense. The biblical wisdom always included a sense of citizenship, but it never was a consecrated citizenship. It never had the element of biblical prophecy in it. But it is one of the classic expressions of basic philosophy. You know, we went to college and we studied 20, 30 men from Aristotle and Plato to Hobbes and Locke and Kant and Whitehead and Russell and so on in our day. But essentially, you can take all of philosophy and boil it down to two points of view. And they're both in our Bible. The first is the prophetic, which begins in human experience. It says that time is short, God's will is burning strong. Get out and do. The other is Stoic, the book of Proverbs in this sense, which insists you live on quicksand, look to your own lasting, mind your own business, don't expect too much, and you won't be too badly hurt. And each of us somehow in his own life resolves this tension, makes some kind of balance between these two positions. The praise that Proverbs gives to wisdom is in the Bible. The prophetic material is also in the Bible. The Bible presents to you these two attitudes because it knows we can't be all one or all the other. We have to make some kind of joining of these two wisdoms. And it's up to us to make it. There, with one short addendum, you have the book of Proverbs. You don't have to believe it, but it's good to read. There's only one other kind of literature in this book. It'll take me 2 minutes to describe it. I didn't know quite how to fit it into the total picture, so I saved it for the end. It's very much like the kind of literature which we remember from the Seder. Who knows one? I know one. One is the God of the world. Who knows 13? And so on. It plays with numbers and uses numbers to help us remember a truth. In chapter 30 of the book of Proverbs, we have a series of these number aphorisms. Two things have I asked of thee, deny me them not before I die. Remove far from me falsehood and lies, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with mine allotted bread, lest I be full and deny and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. Or the one which I love, There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a young woman. Neither has a visible motion, all is emotion. Well, the floor is now open for your questions, which I'll try to handle as best I can. Yes, Esther. Chapter 2, what verse have you in mind, Esther? Then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord, and find the knowledge of God. The word fear of the Lord is Yirat Adonai. Fear doesn't sit well with our 20th century ears, because we've become a little less black and white as far as emotions are concerned. But this is an absolutist society where fear was a daily feeling. You feared your feudal overlord. You feared to go before the king. You had no idea what snap judgment, what peeve might all of a sudden have your head cut off or order your children to be imprisoned or something of this kind. One of the elements which was most associated with royalty was fear, and God was the King of Kings. And so it was natural to associate fear with him. Fear of God has another element, I think, in it. I wish we had a little more fear of God in this sense. Most of us think of God as sort of a good friend whose ear we can bend on the telephone whenever our own friends are too busy to listen. When you're afraid of somebody, you measure your words. With your friends, you never do. And often you're sorry you didn't. We have a way of cheapening our relationships with God because of the lack of the sense of reverence and of distance and of awe. This too is in the element of the fear of God. It's a very common biblical idea. The ancient feared God, very much so. He feared what he might do to him. He feared his wrath, and he feared his anger. And he thought he knew that the storm, the tempest, the hurricane, the whirlwind, the volcanic eruption, death, all these were statements of the fear of God. It was a very natural emotion. And when he meant love of God, he meant something far more than the usual pallid emotion we associate with the word love of God. It was a total involvement on both sides, fear and love. Are awe and fear synonymous? No, they're almost synonymous. Awe is, you know, we like euphemisms. We like to talk of a person as passing away, dead. We like to speak of emotion when we mean passion. We like to say awe because it sounds more respectable than we like fear. But essentially it's that our lives have very little fear in them. The ancient life had a great deal of fear. You may remember fear. Children never raise this question of why do we translate fear, because they know what it means to walk into the principal's office. They can still empathize with it. We may fear the bomb or something like that, but those are distant. As far as focusing fear on a human being, we haven't done them in quite a while as adults. No, I can't say I have, but well, I'm sure in our generation that there are individuals who fear people more than they fear God. And that some people ought to be feared. All the questions answered and the... Yes. How would I compare the Proverbs to the sayings of the fathers? Does everybody know what the sayings of the fathers are? It's a collection of six chapters of this kind of literature in the Mishnah, written between the 2nd century B.C. and the 2nd century A.D. By and large, the sayings of the fathers are more philosophic, more organized, They're written on a, in terms of historical precedence, the earliest teachers first down to the most recent. They're shorter, easier to understand. They're both the same kind of literature, however. There's a great deal of this literature. There's the Wisdom of Ben Sirach, which was written in the second century before the Common Era. There's the Wisdom of Solomon, which is also an apocryphal book, which was written about the first century of the Common Era. There is this. There is the Sayings of the Fathers, and there are a lot of proverbs that are scattered through the early rabbinic literature, which are of the same time. It's hard. There's some that are good, there's some that are not good. It's you can't keep turning out, I don't think, you know, deep proverbs. There's just so many bits of truth in human life. And some of these that you read here misfire completely. They're just superficial. Some of them are very profound. It's intense. That's what's good about it. The greatest problem about our religion today is it's pallid, lukewarm, timid, irrelevant, therefore. I think love and fear are perhaps synonymous elements to a certain degree. You loved your parents deeply, and I suspect there was a good element of fear in it. You love your husband deeply, and I suspect that physical love and the intimacies of marriage have a good bit of fear in them. I'm not going to pry, but I think this is psychologically proven. No, why do I emphasize that I didn't? Esther brought it up. But since she brought it up and gave me the occasion, the great problem with religion in the 20th century is it's a word. It's a study of something that's on the library shelves. It's an interesting historical fact. It's the background of a ritual. It's nothing has to do with what makes you tick, what makes you you.
And until we find a way, each of us, to plunge ourselves back in to pursue it and be pursued by it, to love and to fear, it's going to remain that, a word, a label. What you need is the passion, the emotion. That's a loaded question. The question was, don't I believe that Catholicism is based on fear? I think life is based on fear and love. I mean, you never can separate the two. I think there are certain systems and certain periods in the development of every emotion, every loyalty, every relationship where fear predominates or where love predominates. There are certainly an element of fear. Fear especially of the hereafter and of your inability to enter the hereafter, which is implicit in the Catholic truth. But Catholicism would not be able to channel this if people didn't already believe it. And one of the greatest problems Judaism has is because we refuse to give an answer. People keep coming to me and saying, Rabbi, Rabbi, tell me what's going to happen when I die. And somehow I'm less a rabbi because I can't tell you what's going to happen when I die. And I often wish that, not really, that the answers were a little more simple for me, the way the priest has very simple answers. People want it. I could cure people of depression, despair, really, literally, if I could give them simple answers. You could do a lot. You only go to Lourdes or St. Anne de Beaupré to realize that this is so. But as you create other problems. That's why we've turned away from it. Well, nobody can feel completely, or you would be completely something else. There's not a one of you who is married who has known the completion of the completeness of love, and you know that even at that moment, there was some reservation where you knew you were yourself. The ultimate, the individuality, which is you, is ultimately irreducible. Now, what can you do? It depends upon your station in life, your opportunity in life, your talent in life, your skills, the year in which you're born, the events of the world at that time. And what each of us has to do is to balance out, very simply. You're a 21-year-old boy. You're in college. You're very much exercised about the world. You've plotted for yourself a career in public service. You also know that there's a great, or believe that there's a great virtue in being involved in the Mississippi Project. You go down and take a year off from school and delay your profession. Or you argue to yourself that once I get into the foreign affairs field, then I can do more in terms of world peace. And ultimately, you know, you begin to balance, try and balance these things out. Each of us has a number of these balances to make. The problem with Stoicism is it permits only one answer. Always the hard-headed, cold-eyed answer. Beware of Mr. McCarthy. Measure what you say. Hold back. Withdraw. Don't do any more than is asked of you. Don't give any more in love than you have to simply for the sake of the society. The trouble with passion is that passion can sometimes be irrational, pointless. You can crusade for something that's not worth crusading. You can be involved in an act which destroys your effectiveness for other things. But the point is that you've got to live. And the point is that you've got to, at some time, make a commitment to your age. Most of us spend most of our time being Stoics, manufacturing reasons not to do something. You ask somebody to do something, the instinctive answer of 99 people out of 100 is no. I don't mean the routine things, you know, will you come over for dinner? Or will my child stay with you on going marketing? I'm talking about things which require a bit of work and effort. But 99 out of 100 people will instinctively say no. And then the mind sets the reason, and you can find reason for everything. Anything you want to prove, you can prove by logic. God is or God isn't, right is wrong, wrong is right, justice is injustice, injustice is justice. I can do play intellectual games with you from now to kingdom come. And that's what these are. The passionate person in life says, stop saying no, stop being a nine-dogger. There must be something that you're willing to do. You can't simply lead your life eating and grasping and without concern for others. And ultimately, what I tried to say is that this is the fundamental decision we all have to make. And these two philosophies are in the Bible. I would also say that in the Bible, the greatest weight is given to the prophetic. The book of Proverbs is stuck in the back of the Bible. And the book of Ecclesiastes, you know, vanity of vanity, all of vanities, is also stuck in the back of the Bible. It can't be denied. There's good common sense. But the spiritual sense, the sacred sense, is beyond the common. And ultimately, we have to say what the Christians love to quote, I'm a fool for God. I'll do something that puts my own life in jeopardy, my own success in the balance. I'm not sure how we got sermonic from the book of Proverbs, but this is its basic interest, I think. Well, it's been a pleasure. Next week, I got your train. Next week, we're going to deal with what is probably the most fascinating of these books, the book of Job. And if you get a chance between now and next week, read it over, so you're a little better prepared for it. Thank you. Here, now, in this real life. The rabbis capsuled this wisdom in the phrase, Ashrei Ha'ish Someach B'Chelko. The secret of happiness is man's ability to accept his own circumstance. You do not need to be a Nobel laureate to make a contribution to the ongoing development and progress of man. You do so daily in your business as you conduct yourself with honor. You do so daily as your home, as your love and your teaching raises children straight and strong, sturdy, steadfast. You do so in your civic undertakings where the extending of your health, the granting and the giving of time and of effort lends strength to the needs of the city. Now we all have fantasies. We all listen to what Dr. Freud once called the lullabies of heaven. Those wonderful, ethereal melodies which come to us from a never-never land, where all the limitations of this life are somehow made complete, where all the loneliness of this life is somehow forgiven in thunderous applause, where all the failures and frustrations of this life turn into a golden success. We all dream. To live is to dream. But we cannot live in our dreams. Dreaming, we destroy the happiness that can be ours. For our dreams place our ambitions so high. Our dreams cause us to live by a standard which we cannot attain, and they sap, they take from us the ability to enjoy that which truly can be ours. You do not have to sit in the seats of power in order to affect the course of your life. You do not have to have amassed all wealth to have become the president of a giant corporation in order to be secure. And yet if you are nagged by this fantasy, if it gives you no peace, you may have enough, a sufficiency and then some, and know only unhappiness. You do not need the beauty of a Venus in order to be loved or to know love. The beauty is that inner grace and charm, which is personality, which is a human being at peace with himself or herself, is not some inherited external form. And yet if you are caught up with some adolescent conjuration of beauty, what peace can be yours? What love can be yours? Or whatever grace is yours by birth will never be enough. We must learn to live for the world that is ours. The beginning of wisdom, the beginning of maturity, is our acceptance of our banishment from paradise, and our willingness to live in this world, a world of death and of pain, a world in which men are mortal and fallible, a world in which men can be cynical and callous one to another. The beginning of wisdom is a willingness to live in this world without regret, to accept it for what it is, to seek to make it an even better place. The gates of paradise are locked. The Greek word utopia means simply no place. There is no paradise. Lo haya, lo nibra. Paradise is locked tight. The gates of the promised land are always open. At the beginning of our history, God covenanted with Abraham, lift up your eyes and look about this place. For all the land which thou seest, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee, as an eternal inheritance. The focus of our long history is simply this, the desire to be on the land, to possess the land, and to build upon it a promise equal to the blessing. The patriarchs came to the Holy Land, and they pastured their flocks there, and they camped there. And they left the land only when they were driven off by drought or by famine, the need to seek pasture elsewhere. But always they returned. And then we were taken off the land again by our enslavement in Egypt, and we remained deprived of the land for many centuries. And then came the Passover, and God's deliverance from bondage. And then came Moses, and he led the people back to the very gates of promise. And so it has always been in our history. As it was under Joshua, we have pioneered the land. As it was under the judges and under the kings, we built high its cities, we tilled its farms and its vineyards, we understood and enjoyed its wealth. And there were times when the vicissitudes of history turned against us. We were driven off the land, but always we kept close to dream, always the land beckoned. And as in our own generation, it reached out to us across the centuries and drew us back. We renewed the land, and we rebuilt it. And there are some, the cynics, who say that over the archway of birth, there ought to be inscribed the phrase, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Our Bible insists, through the vision of the promised land, that life is something more than a barren, difficult enterprise. There are hopes that do come true. There are dreams that can be realized. It may take 40 years of wilderness wandering to come to the promised land. It may take centuries of human undertaking to build a high civilization. But the land is there. The civilization can be built. The promise can be found. How does our hope for a promised land differ from the fantasies of paradise? Paradise is ethereal. It is unreal. It is no place. The promised land is acreage. It is a fact of geography. It is within time, place. We dream of paradise, and we dream of immortality. Something impossible. Man. We dream of the promised land when we devote ourselves to the healing sciences and seek within the terms of mortality to increase man's ability, his strength, his ability to enjoy the years which are by God's decision his. We dream of paradise when we dream of a world of saintly people, a world where everyone in a sense is created after our own image. We dream of the promised land. When we dream of building the welfare of the whole, when we establish justice, when we found righteousness within the social order. Paradise is an ethereal place. The promised land is this place. Now each of us has his own vision for private promised land. We wish, we pray, we dream of a certain scope for our skills. We wish, we pray, we dream for a certain security for our family. We wish, we pray, we dream for a certain place and respect of our community. And it is good to dream. And if we rein in these dreams within the realm of the possible, it can be achieved. Even it requires every ounce of energy, every devotion, sacrifice in our part. Man is meant to dream. We are meant to have a vision splendid towards which we guide and direct and focus our every act. A grand dream ennobles life, but too grand a dream. A dream drawn from the world of fancy. Too grand a dream is an illness. The mania. Destroys life, it dooms our efforts before we undertake them. We become like the ancient Icarus of Greek legend. Remember the man who built himself crude wings of wax in order to fly to the sun? And how he rose a few miles off the earth, and then the heat of the atmosphere burned the wax, and he plunged headlong into the roiling sea. Our dreams need to be constructed of the stuff of life. We need to be within the reach of our talents. We need to be within the facts of our circumstances. We cannot change the human being that we are
We cannot give ourselves talents we did not inherit. We cannot convert ourselves from one type of human being to another. All that we can do is to hone sharply the skills that are ours. All that we can do is to use the powers which are ours sufficiently. And these powers are sufficient to lead a good life, to contribute to our world, to know love, to know responsibility, to discharge significant duties. The promised land is back, not friends. But the promised land is something more than mere fact. The promised land is more than conquest, more than another nation, more than success, more than the reaching of the top of the greasy pole. Our ancestors conquered the land. The promised land was theirs. They lived in its cities, they built high its palaces, they leveled its roads, they farmed its hillsides. And it was not the promised land for which they had come. And the finest of the spirits of our ancestors, the prophets, came among them and said, how have you despoiled this dream? How did you fail to understand that you must not only own the land, cultivate it, know its wealth? It was your responsibility to build upon this land a society which was full of decency and dignity, of justice and of freedom. Yours is a promised land only insofar as it becomes a holy land, a land which reflects in its institutions and its citizens God's law, a divine way, a goodly life. You are too busy being busy with your business. You are too busy mining the wealth of the earth, taking the toll of trade, enjoying the profit of your craft, eating the harvest of your fields. This is not the promise, the full promise of this land. Here was the land given to you for holy purpose, to love the good, to establish justice in the gates, to eradicate the injustice of class and of caste. And what did you do? What did you do? You became indulgent. Luxury made some of you into vultures. Indolence made others of you into grasshoppers. Prosperity perverted you. And you changed this land into simply another place of dwelling for another of the many tribes of the divinity. The promised land is not only success, the material success of which we dream, but a spiritual success. The attainment of the millennial vision of all men for a better world, a more decent life, a higher level of dignity and of opportunity for all. But what is success? What success is ours if we have what the world calls success, the tinsel? But in the process we have tarnished our good name. We have exhausted and broken our health, and we have so drawn away from our families that they are alien to us. What is the virtue of success if it does not bring happiness? What is the virtue of the promised land if it is not established in freedom? What is the virtue of all of our undertakings if it does not bring good and goodness into life? And let me apply this for a moment to our own present vision of the Holy Land. Most of us agree with our president and his image of the Great Society. What is this image but a contemporary vision of the promised land? And it is a realistic vision. Thank God our land is sufficiently abundant to provide for all. Thank God our machine is sufficiently intricate to provide for all. Thank God our surplus is sufficiently great to provide the education and the training and the leisure and the recreation and the decency, which is the birthright of every man. Poverty can be eradicated. Illiteracy can be erased. the ancient divisions of race and class will be overcome. The great society is a realizable dream that falls in the category of the promised land. But is it enough? What will we have? What will we have if we erase poverty? If we erase and tear down the slum? If every man has opportunity, and every man exploits that opportunity in selfish purpose. Israel was never more prosperous as it was under the days of such kings as Omri and Ahab, and never more pain. The people turned away from the God of their fathers. Wealth became a mirage which drew them on to ever greater gluttony and greed. Indolence led to idleness, leisure led to vice, and the great vision of promise led to the destruction of the people. And I look about myself at this gracious land of ours, a land which can imagine realistically for the first time to achieve the great society, and I wonder if we have the human capacity really to create the great society. We have declared war on poverty, thank God. Finally, war is to be used for a constructive purpose against the ugliest of facts of human style. We declared war on poverty. But how many among us have already declared themselves conscientious objectors in this war? How many among us want no part in this battle? There are the greedy, and there are many. They are those who say to us, we will not pay the taxes for the welfare of the whole. Let each man take care of himself. And many of our best citizens are among the greedy, among those who oppose each and every taxation, each and every welfare program. And there are the careful, those who say, yes, hire a professional army. Marshal the social workers and the teachers of our land. Let them go in and tutor and enlighten and bring these people out of their darkness. For me, I want no part. I will not give a single hour. My time, my precious time, the time I so beautifully fritter away, I will not give an hour of my time to this undertaking. And there are the stunted people. People who enjoy living with their medieval prejudices, who will not welcome a man of another background into their neighborhood, who will not hire a person of another color into responsibility. And there are the careless men, a generation which has gone to sea in the search for the thrill, for the sport, which seeks only indulgence, leisure, opportunity to enjoy itself, to live off the fatness of the land, but which will not return to the land which has given them all this, a single iota of their own strength and wit. And I see all these people now, before the great battle has been won, even before it has been joined. And I ask myself if the ancient evils erased, we will indeed have the human stuff create and achieve decency within the great society. Woe unto them who are at ease in Zion. So the prophet Amos. And Amos told the people what I am telling you this morning, that they were of the promised land, that the promise can slip easily from their grasp. Lamentation will yet be heard in the streets of Jerusalem unless you learn to hate the evil, you learn to love the good, you learn to establish justice in your gates, you learn to undertake the responsibilities of citizenship seriously, you learn to undertake the responsibilities of community, of dignity, with a willingness to share, broaden, paradise. There is no paradise. The promised land, we are almost there. Just around the corner. A land flowing with milk and honey. A land whose cities reach to the very heavens. A land whose institutions are more generous and more gracious and more full of opportunity than any heretofore even conceived by man. The ancient utopian visions do not begin to approximate today's reality. Have we the stuff here? Within the promised land. Can we secure it? Can we found it solid? Can we reject its excess, the siren call of its richness, and remain dedicated human beings, devoted to the law, devoted to the good, devoted to God and God's will? Our chance and our hope.